are listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik from the land of the Goths, southwest of Sweden. Thank you for stopping by. I hope you had a good week, everybody. Our website is redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. And by the way, before we proceed to today's program, just a technical update for our members here first. I don't know if you recall, but we had a really stubborn iOS 8 problem that arose when Apple made their new update some months ago now. For a while, we had to refer our iPhone and iPad users to use a podcast app. Well, just want to let you know that that is no longer the case, no longer necessary. You can now go in and listen to the program, as usual, with the player right on the members' website or by using the download buttons, whatever you prefer. But, I mean, I personally prefer actually to use a podcast app because it's so easy. The show comes right to you once it's out. But anyway, we wanted to make this fix for you so that you can go to the site and listen. Also, of course, if you want to check out the links, the related shows, the book titles, and of course, read comments and comment yourself. So that is now done for iPhone and iPad users. And for Android users, when you are on the members' website, we do recommend that you use the Download Hour 1 and Download Hour 2 buttons. You know, touch those to listen to 1 hour at a time. When you do this, you get an option to either download the file to your Android system, or you can play them with your sound player or, you know, Google Play or any other app that you have installed that plays music and audio and whatnot. But yeah, just a quick update on that. Don't use the player as there is an issue to play the second hour. It doesn't automatically begin after that, but we're looking into that as we speak to be able to fix that as well. So keep that in mind if you're an Android user. You can, of course, also just listen through the podcast app, and we do have a couple of recommendations for that in our FAQ help section. So go there to see all the details on how to listen with various devices and systems, however you actually listen to this show as a member. And just one more note on this. We're also going to redesign the members' website here soon to become more mobile-friendly. We've just been so busy, we've had no time to do some of the updates that we've wanted to do on the websites. But we're going to do that, folks. It's queued up, so we hope to be able to bring that to you soon. So thank you so much, by the way, for your patience on this, and we hope to bring you a much easier layout for mobile and other devices here soon. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's introduce our guest here today, Gilad Atzmon. He's a British jazz artist and author. He was born in Israel in 1963 and trained at the Rubin Academy of Music in Jerusalem, studying composition and jazz. He plays saxophones, clarinet, and ethnic woodwind instruments. Atzmon tours extensively around the world. His albums, of which he has recorded 15 to date, often explore political themes and the music of the Middle East. As a member of Blockheads, Gilad also has recorded and performed with Ian Dury, Robbie Williams, Sinead O'Connor, and Paul McCartney. Gilad has also recorded with Robert Wyatt, The Waterboys. In 2014, he recorded with Pink Floyd and is featured on their last album, The Endless River. In 2000, Gilad founded the Orient House Ensemble in London and started redefining his own roots in light of his emerging ethical awareness. Gilad writes on political matters, social issues, Jewish identity, and culture, and that's why he's with us today to discuss some of these things. He has a couple of novels, Guide to the Perplexed, and My One and Only. They've been translated into 24 languages. His latest book, The Wandering Who, is a study of Jewish identity politics. It was published in October 2011. We have a lot to speak about today, but we'll begin on the recent news of the controversy surrounding the cancellation of his concert at the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester, England, due to pressure from a Zionist group concerning his political views. We'll get the story from Gilad as we begin. Gilad, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us again. It's great speaking with you. Hope you've been doing well since we last spoke. It's been a few years now.
Yeah, it is like 2 or 3 years, I think, since the publication of The Wandering Wandering Who, I think. It's like probably 3 years or something.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Very happy to talk to you. I follow what you're doing. It's incredible. Admiration.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And same to you, Gilad. You're very brave. And of course, the way you're speaking out about many of the issues that we talk about as well. I thought we could begin. I have a lot of things I want to ask you about today. I think we've got you at a good time as well. We have a lot of things going on with Of course, Netanyahu being in the U.S., speaking at first APAC and then in front of Congress. We can definitely get your take on that later. But let's begin with the cancellation story. RNCM canceled your appearance with your band. What happened there? Tell us about it.
Yeah, I was supposed to be, actually, I'm talking to you today. Today is Thursday. I was supposed to be in Manchester now, sound checking before the gig. And I think on Monday at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, half past five, my manager called me and told me, Gilad, you won't believe it, because a few hours earlier, he just got report on ticket sales and it looked quite okay. You won't believe it. The gig in Manchester was just pulled out. I immediately called the venue to understand what was going on. And I spoke with the marketing guy, and he told me that there were some issues to do with safety. I was quite surprised, you know, because I'm doing it for 30 years. And as you can imagine, occasionally I encounter threats and so on. But I feel kind of, you know, I'm quite big, and I feel I'm a confident person, you know, and you know, I, you know, obviously when I start the car in the morning, I put earplugs in case there is a blast, you know, I just don't want to hear, you know, I was sure that it was a joke, because I didn't see anything. He told me, listen, there is a security. We cannot ensure your safety or the audience. And so I thought, wow, they are threatened. I told him to go to the police. He said, we don't want to enter. We don't want to get into this territory, and so on and so on. An hour later, 2 hours later, I realized that there was a petition by a body called the Northwest Friends of Israel.
Mm.
In the morning or in the day later, you know, the college, this college is a very important college of music, and it's a very prestigious and precious venue for many of us. You know, it's one of those venues that we, you know, I'm here for 20 years and I played it 3 times in my entire career. You really look forward to play there. It's a nice place.
Yeah.
Very nice acoustics. And day after, they published their statement and they said it has nothing to do with any political discussion. We had to cancel the gig because we realized that we couldn't ensure safety of people involved, which was a very clear admission that they were threatened. And as it happened, this situation really played into my hands, because it became clear that a body that is, by admission, aligned itself with another country, with a foreign country, has foreign interests. They called themselves the Northwest Friend of Israel. Israel, I try to make it like to give my Israeli accent, you know, some extra power.
Yeah.
Israel, people who are not loyal to Britain, loyal to Israel by admission, have managed to mount pressure to intimidate one of our most prestigious and precious cultural institutes.
Yeah.
This is unheard of. Now I came to live in Britain because I regarded it as a free country, and here I'm here for 20 years and I'm having good time. You know, I'm one of the most established artists here. I'm regarded as the hardest gigging British jazz artist.
Yeah,
I'm a star here, let's say. You know, it's like embarrassing. And this idiotic extremist Zionist in the open mounting pressure on me, on my career, spreading lies on me. I have thousands of followers here, you know.
Sure.
Now
yeah.
I never been involved in any petition, but as soon as it was you know, this the cancellation was established, I you know, this, you cannot hide anything anymore, because it was immediately on the net. And I said on the net immediately that I was told by the theater that it was a safety issue. And then a few hours later, they admitted. It was very clear that we here in Britain were intimidated by Israeli lobby group. Now, we see our politicians being subject to this unique, vile Jewish pressure all the time. It happened in the parliament, you know, if somebody would say something that doesn't suit the Israeli lobby, they will immediately would be kicked out from their parties and face as the most severe measures.
Yeah.
Funny enough, the British public remains silent.
They do. Yeah.
You understand? Yeah, yeah. You know, say, oh, you poor, you know, and Jenny Tong. Oh, you know, it's never, you know. But when it happened to a jazz artist. And I'm a jazz artist, you know. So, you know, so I played with some famous people, maybe. But really, I'm not Paul McCartney. I'm not Bob Dylan. You know, I'm not a person that every person in Britain. No, I'm not a household name, really.
But you played with Paul McCartney, right?
Yeah, I played him within the Blockheads, you know. But I obviously Sideman. I was doing the brass.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's completely. Something that is meaningless to his career, I guess. maybe not anymore because now I'm famous. But
oh man, yeah, that's no, good.
But it's good. But I'm not a household name. Suddenly, you know, there was a you know like I saw because a lot of those emails copied to me. The Royal College went under barrage of a protest. Today, I went to the BBC. I hope that they broadcast it because I was supposed to be there in a kind of a TV interview. And I learned after that the Jewish guy, the Zionist guy, the head of this Northwest Friends of Israel didn't even appear to the debate because I was surprised. They spoke with me for 15 minutes. You know, I said, you know, they're not going to give me the entire BBC news tonight. But I'm afraid now that because he didn't come, they won't be able to broadcast it because maybe it won't be partial. I hope that he sent a statement or something.
Right.
Basically, they're running now. They're hiding. Because also, what I came and said, so we have Jews misbehaving in Manchester, at the time, the leaders of the Jewish community in this country are complaining of the rise of anti-Semitism. So why does hardcore Zionists think that if they come and intimidate a Manchester venue, it would make the Jews more lovable?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Obviously wrong. So what I told the BBC, and this I hardly believe that this would make it into the air, is that as we all know, anti-Semitism is not kind of a secret going gene. It is always reaction to Jewish bad behavior. This is something that a lot of people are upset by, but it is, by the way, you know, a normal thing when you think about it. You know, if America dropped tomorrow a bomb on a Pakistani village and killed a lot of civilians, you know, this would create a lot of opposition to American. To American people, and there would maybe some people who may target American interests.
Of course, yeah.
So this would be a reaction to American bad behavior.
Yeah.
You know, when a few Muslims, as if it is the case or whatever, enter Charlie Hebdo, millions of Muslims in Europe, innocent, completely innocent, are subject to a lot of pressure, again, because of Muslim bad behavior. So I say exactly the same rule applies to the Jews.
Sure.
Anti-Semitism is a reaction to Jewish bad behavior. What is very interesting about the Jewish culture, the Jews, for some reason, and it's very interesting, and you know, we may have to think about it, lack this necessary capacity to look in the mirror, to self-reflect, and to understand how dangerous it is, you know?
Right.
I was very happy to see the Jewish News here. It's called jewishnews.co.uk. I don't know. I'm not following every Jewish outlet. I have to watch good-looking women on the internet from time to time. I'm so happy with the internet. But I watched this. I saw this article that, and he wrote, it was very interesting. He said, I hate what Gilad is saying. Obviously, he doesn't know what I'm saying. And I hate his Holocaust denial. I really want to know once, you know, they show me where did I deny the Holocaust. I just insist that it must be subject to an historical investigation.
Right.
This is my take anyway, but he said, but by boycotting Gilad, we actually lost our moral ground against the BDS movement.
Of course, yeah.
The BDS movement is, if they say we oppose the cultural and academic boycott, suddenly we are behaving exactly like the BDS. And I all the time say that the BDS, the cultural boycott, is actually a very, very Jewish symptom. It is called cherem in Hebrew. Cherem, it's quite strange. H-E-R-E-M, which is what you call in English excommunication.
Right.
It is, you know, boycotting. It's at the core of the Jewish culture in a village with one Jew. How many synagogues you need? Two. One to go to and one to boycott.
Yes? Right.
The Jews start to move around to understand their entity once they have someone to oppose. It's a negation. It's an identity that is based on negation. So this boy realized, his name is Gabriel Weber or whatever, he realized that actually they lost completely the moral ground in their battle against the boycott. And I say for years, Jews are not against boycott. They just don't like to be boycotted.
Yeah.
You know, it's very simple.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I opened the computer. I just came back from the BBC. And I realized that the BBC wrote a very big article pretty much in my favor. I just put it on my website. And then I, 5 minutes after that, the Evening Standard, no, it's not the Evening Standard, the Manchester Evening or Manchester Standard. It's a kind of the biggest paper it's the evening, Manchester Evening paper, came with a very big article. Again, you know, I'm not used to get to see my views explode by the most established mainstream outlets in Britain, as you probably imagine.
Sure.
Thanks to this Jewish Zionist lobby group, I'm now in the biggest outlet. The Guardian called me last night. And I tell you the truth, I really hope that they can see my dates and then we start to work together. They are better, they cost me nothing, and they're slightly more effective than my PR guy.
I hope that, of course, exactly.
You know, he struggles to get kind of a small review in a downbeat or in, you know. They just get me, you know, to the broadsheets, you know.
So it's good for publicity, yeah.
But I don't really care about publicity. I'm very entertained to see people in Britain reading my views. I cannot ask for more than that.
Well, exactly. I was going to ask you about that because the charges here, if I can put it that way, said that you were, you know, by allowing this performance at the RNCM, and again, for those who don't know, it stands for, it's Manchester's Royal Northern College of Music. But they said that, you know, they will be party to fostering anti-Semitism and the possibility of attacks on Jewish people. and institutions in Manchester. That's what they said, you know.
Yeah, yeah, obviously, and as the once the RNCM looked into it, they realized that it's complete nonsense. In my entire career, not a single complaint about my music or talks has ever been logged. You know, nobody complained. A lot of people tried to prevent me from talking or apparently now from playing, but there is no complaint of people who've been in my concert said he said A, B, C, and needless to say that not once in my life I was asked, I was questioned by a single law enforcement authority. They speak about my book being the most anti-Semitic text in recent time. This is I always like to be very very famous for something, but my book is legal all over the world. It's a bestseller in America and here in the in England, in France as well. It is not there is not a single place on this planet where this book is illegal. It came out in Germany, in France, in Italy, in countries that have a very severe Holocaust denial legislation.
Yeah.
And the book is 100% legal and selling, and sometimes selling a lot. So it was very easy for me to show that the arguments are totally unfounded, or they didn't even try to substantiate. Amazingly enough, these idiots, all the references to my wrongdoing was based on an article written by no other than Alan Dershowitz.
Of course, yeah.
Now, you know that we have a lot of serious issues in this country with revelations about networks, really massive networks of pedophiles that were operating within the BBC and so on and
absolutely.
So on.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, one of the most famous pedophiles is Jimmy Savile, who was a very, he was a, really a one of the first big celebrities of the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, we have this Dershowitz, who is accused of sex, brutal, quite brutal sex with minors. You know, I don't know whether it is true or not, but he's definitely implicated in this horrid story. And you know, in America, he's regarded as a dirty old man. But for these Jewish Friends of Israel, he is an authority. Would anyone try to cancel my gig using denunciation by Jimmy Savile? You
right,
know,
right.
Oh, Jimmy
exactly.
Savile said it didn't like a Gilad Atzmon. You know, but this is actually very interesting because it reveals something about Jewish power.
Sure.
Again, about this blindness. You know, so we have a person here that is becoming universally infamous for his activity with alongside Jeffrey Epstein, an arch pedophile, a huge that was charged with being a pimp of girls, 40 of them, you know.
Yeah, to a lot of other famous people, by the way. Prince Andrew is drawn into this, even Bill Clinton, tons of people that was on his Jeffrey Epstein's lists.
Exactly, something that nobody would dare touching. And then you have this Zionist network, and they're using this very horrid man that nobody would even touch with a barge pole.
Yeah.
You know, so this is, again, this sense of omnipotence, impunity, the belief that you can say whatever you want, you can do whatever you like, and it explained to us exactly what happened in the Congress 2 days ago.
Right, exactly. I want to ask you more about that later. So do you think the RNCM then went to your website, looked into what you've written about to try to vet you, because ultimately they turned around and said, well, we think it's a security issue, meaning also we wouldn't be able to protect you. That's what they said, right?
She said, yeah. They told me, listen, we cannot protect you, and we cannot also protect the audience. And I thought to myself, this is quite scary. For me, the fact that a person who is not loyal to Britain is loyal to Israel managed to scare British people, and they're even scared to go to the police because they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Now, this means that in Manchester today, they have something similar. You have they share something with the people in Gaza. They are both brutalized, vandalized by some Zionist-centric activity. Basically, we make, unless I argue now, and I'm about to publish something, what we see here is in 2015, battle on Britain. If we want to maintain or to sustain freedom in this country, we have to stand up and say, enough of Zionist intimidation, enough of Jewish power, enough of Jewish politics interfering with British, American, French national interests.
Yeah.
We have to learn to call a spade a spade. This is what Jewish power is all about. It is very dangerous, and there is no way to tackle it unless we name it and brave enough to look in it in the eyes. At it in the eyes.
Yeah, I agree. Well said. I mean, this is really also kind of exploded after Paris, Charlie Hebdo, but also Copenhagen, and the way that Netanyahu has tried to kind of use this issue for his own purposes. It's been interesting to watch this as he's trying to get basically every Jew back to Israel. There seems to be some internal tension here as well. We even saw that now, polarizing the Jews in America, right? Saying that they're not, Netanyahu doesn't speak for us, kind of thing. So we're seeing kind of a schism here occurring. Maybe it's artificial, maybe it's not. I don't know.
I'm not impressed when Jews convey the image of pluralism and internal debate. It took me just a few years living amongst diaspora Jews to understand that this political spiel, I would call it, is set to convey an image of pluralism rather than being a genuine debate. It took me quite a few years to understand that the Jewish anti-Zionism or the Jewish anti-Zionist network is operating, in fact, as a control opposition apparatus.
Right, right.
It is there to actually divert the attention from the real issues. So, for instance, they insist that we talk about Israeli colonialism. Israel is not colonialism. Zionism is not colonialism. I explained it many times. Colonialism is a clear set of exchange between a mother state and a settler state. Israel is a settler state, but it doesn't have a Jewish mother state. So why do they call it colonialism? Because then the Jewish settlement in Palestine is not a unique event in history. So they want us to call it colonialism in order to divert the attention from Jewishness.
Right, yeah.
They call it apartheid, again, because apartheid would mean that it's not a unique case in history. It is like South Africa, or South United States, and there is always post-apartheid and post-colonialism. Israel is not apartheid. Apartheid is a racist system of exploitation. The Jewish settlement in Palestine is not an exploitive system. It wants the Palestinian out. It's an ethnic cleanser that is driven by a racist philosophy. It's not even like National Socialist. It's an Hitlerian model. It's a model that actually copied the most radical form of Hitlerism. So again, we are using all those misleading notions in order to divert the attention from the Jewishness of the Jewish state. Now, as bizarre as it may sound, we have the Jewish left from Amy Goodman, Democracy Now, to through Mondo Weiss and Max Blumenthal and Real News, diverting the attention, vetting the discourse. And then, shockingly enough, we have Benjamin Netanyahu, Avigdor Lieberman, Naftali Bennett, the most radical, ardent, hawkish Israeli politicians, who actually passing the Israel National Bill, who are saying this is the Jewish state and everything we are doing is driven by our Jewishness. So bizarrely enough, the Jewish left is saturating the discourse with lies, while the Jewish right-wing ultra hawkish elements are actually insisting to tell us the truth about the nature of this state. This is very, very fascinating. It is very, very embarrassing. And it is and one of the reasons that nothing good happened to Palestine is because for many years this discourse has been dominated by Jewish left. A very fascinating story. You know, we have an organization here. They are called Jews for Justice for Palestinians. Jews for Justice for Palestinians. JF, PJ, all this, a lot of J's with a few letters in between. Yeah, one of those. Yeah, and they are kind of an offshoot of JVP or whatever. When this organization was established, they were called Jews for Justice for Palestine. And then very quickly, they changed it into Jews for Justice for Palestinians.
Right.
Why? Because they realized that within the Jewish community, they cannot call it Justice for Palestine because they were not allowed to acknowledge that there is such a thing called Palestine.
Yeah.
A few days ago, a friend of mine, she is a Muslim convert, she is a great woman, Laura Stewart, sent me a kind of an exchange at Yed with Jay Big. Jay Big is not a kosher dildo company. It is actually it's the Jews for boycott of Israeli goods. Yeah, I when I saw Jay Big in the beginning, you know, because I'm from a Jewish origin, I thought that maybe I can get an enlargement pill or something. But apparently, you know, it is kind of it's innocent. Laura is a Muslim convert. She wasn't a Jew before. I think that she was English Church or Anglican Church, but. She asked, they asked people to like their page. And then she asked, can I join you, Jay Big? And they told her, I have the answer. I have to put it. I have a photo of it. They told her straight away. They told her, you cannot join us because you're not Jewish, but you can like our Facebook page. Now, this is amazing, yeah? Because in the Israeli parliament, in the next election, we will have between 13 to 15 Arab members. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because now the Arab part is united, you know, so this Arab Union, they are probably going to be the third biggest party in Israel. Yeah. Wow. So in the Israeli parliament, in the Zionist, the way they call it, we have the third party is going to be Arab party, while in the case of the Jewish anti-Zionist, so-called progressive, they don't have a single Muslim or Christian or a Goy, a Gentile, on the board because yep, they're racially exclusive.
Yeah.
You know? So, again, I show you like this debate between Zionist and anti-Zionist is imaginary. And it was obviously very easy for me to suss it out, to understand that this is the case. And why? Because I noticed that when they started to chase me, they were always walking together. They were walking, the Jewish anti-Zionist with the most hardcore Zionist were walking, they were united, they were walking together to destroy me. And I then realized that there is something that unites them. And it's very simple. It's the Jewishness.
Yeah.
You know, so you know... I don't take the Jewish political polarity very seriously at all.
Yeah, I that was my feeling as well. I saw, you know, Dianne Feinstein speaking out, saying that Netanyahu doesn't speak for us, many others as well. There was even another, I think it was a more left-leaning group that also petitioned. I think they managed to get like 20,000 signatures to try to prevent Netanyahu from speaking. But that was my feeling as well. It wasn't, they still didn't kind of really address the core issues of certain things here that were just kind of...
By the way, this is, there is a, you know, you are a very inspiring human being. So while talking to you, you know, a lot of kind of an intellectual associations come into play. But I think that this whole topic of speaking to us or not speaking to us, you know, if Tony Blair would go abroad, you know, would start to meet Brits or tell you speaking for us or not speaking to us. This is all an something that introduced into our discourse by identity politics, which is at large a Jewish phenomenon that was pushed by the Frankfurt School or the late Frankfurt School. We have been told to not to speak as Enric or Gilad or John or Stuart or Leslie, but to speak you know, so we speak as a Jew, as a Muslim, as a Black, as a lesbian, as a Swede, and so on and so on.
Now, let me interrupt you there. I'd say identity politics, from my perspective anyway, do kind of exclude one group here, and it's the hierarchy of victims here does not include white people. In Sweden, for example, we're not protected under hate speech laws and things like this, you know.
The white people are obviously the enemy.
Yep.
You know, as far as the identity politics. Now, the great preachers of identity politics, even within the Black, you know, civil rights movement, were Jews, and the reason is very simple, because once we take a society and we start to slice it into identity groups, yeah, the white disappears. The white disappears. So you look at Americans, you know, when I was young, and I'm starting to get old now, I'm 51 years old. When I was young, I would ask Americans I would meet in Europe, where are you from? And tell them, I'm from Boston. I'm, you know, who are you? You know, and, you know, they would identify as Americans, but mainly with geography, where they are from geographically. When you ask Americans now, they tell, I'm Russian Dutch.
Right.
I'm Polish black. I'm a Latino, you know.
Right.
And basically, we even managed to fragment the isolated human subjectivity.
Yeah.
We have managed to break you into a kind of infinitesimal fragments just to make sure that you don't know what you are, who you belong, who you can unite with. But interestingly enough, you know, this project that was supposed to protect the rights of minorities and marginal groups actually dismantled them completely. Mm. Why? Because instead of the old left ideology, I've never been kind of a proper leftist, but I have respect to old left, to old unionist left. Instead of the old unionist left that told us the complete opposite, it doesn't matter if you're black, if you're Jew, if you're Swede, if you're Russian, if you're lesbian. If you are a worker, you are part of us. Instead of those kind of proletarian bond, we have now the working class divided into endless sectors.
Yeah.
And it is engaged in endless sectarian wars.
Exactly.
You know, so the Hispanics with the black and the black with the Jews with everyone.
Well, and this is kind of where the new the progressive left and so was the new left, but where they kind of intersect with you know, with some of the new consumer materialist market forces, right?
Absolutely. And this exactly now this is a very good point. And why? Because once instead, you know, the three most important thing in society, I think, maybe I'm wrong, are work, health, and education. In the old unionist left, we could basically see this triangle of prominent issues at the heart of our political discourse. But now, with all those sectarian idiotic issues, we have to fight with anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and black issues and the most important, anti-Semitism. Yeah,
yeah.
The rise of anti-Semitism, and nobody gives attention to make sure that all of us have a working place, that manufacturing is maintained, is sustained, that we have,
yeah,
you know, that we can go 7 o'clock in the morning and come back 5 or 6 in the evening with bread and butter. So manufacturing was kicked out of the window. In schools, we just learned how to not identify with ourselves, but to fit into kind of a correct model of that makes us into subservient consumers. And health system is falling apart, and all of that is because we are thinking as a Jew, as a Muslim, as a woman. We think sectorially instead of bonding together around one single or dual basic ideologies. Now, what would be a unifying philosophy that could get us all together? Equality, for instance. Equality. Some we really live in equality. Another concept is patriotism, nationalism, love to the soil.
Yeah.
So for instance, if we understand that we love our country, we love Britain, and we want to live in equality or something that resembles equality, this would mean that we, the British people, I hope that nobody is offended of me calling myself Brit, you know, without even being able to speak the language, you know.
You know. You speak good enough, yeah.
Yeah, I hope, you know, but, you know, I'm sure that you approve. But
as a Swede, yes, I do.
But, you know, it would mean that we buy a British car. And if I buy a British car, the guy in Bedford, in Vauxhall factory in Bedford, may have the money to come to see me when I play in town.
Sure.
This is how we start to support each other.
Yep, that's right.
But it doesn't fit very nicely with the dream of the EU.
Well, exactly. And these are, I would say, very kind of later, not what you're talking about, but the problem here is a very later kind of artificial thing, because we have an overlap here when this, we're now in the time when multiculturalism is becoming corporate monoculture. But having said that, though, we used to be in a state before, you know, where people were more cohesive before artificial multiculturalism, population displacement through wars and mass immigration. So we've seen a tremendous transformation. Look at, I can just take Sweden as an example. We were very equal. We were admired around the world for a lot of our systems that we had, education, health, and these kinds of things. But when some of the corporate, you know, monoculture market forces came in, they brought multiculturalism, and now we're moving towards corporate monoculture, complete destruction of everything we had built, you know?
Yeah, it is very clear. It is very clear. And one of the first thing that you lost was your industry.
Yep.
Was your industry. And, you know, as an ex-Jew, I can tell you a lot about Volvo.
Yeah.
You know, the Volvo, it's our favorite car. It looks like a tank. It is amphibious. And it is not German.
Right.
It's a real car.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of Jews driving Volvos. You're right. Yeah.
No, man. When a Jew drives Volvo, you know, he doesn't even need the eyes.
Yeah. Well, that's it's not Swedish anymore. That's what's the shame about
it.
You know.
I know. No, but you know, this is the issue. No, but when you look at cars, I'm not a great expert on cars, but you know, the Swedish cars were very unique. We're very unique, whether it is Volvo or Saab.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think that Saab is completely gone by now. Am I right?
Pretty much. They're still actually going remarkably, but they're trickling. It's, you know.
Yeah, but you know, these cars were very innovative technologically.
Sure, yeah.
They were very, very different. And we lost, and English cars were very unique. You know, the kind of a car was a face of a nation.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's a sound, you know, and this is something that we completely lost, you know, to identify rather than to identify with the vague notion of identity that actually removes one from authenticity.
Yeah.
We used to see in our products a glorious manifestation of our true selves.
And the differences between us, the different, you know,
exactly.
Qualities, yeah,
exactly.
Properties. Yeah.
You know, French car, you know, they always sounded funny. You know, they have this accent, you know, the diesel car, you know, the French, you know, they're very good cars. No, I'm not, my description of is very pictorial. You know, I'm not talking about, horsepower. But, you know, they had a very unique design, you know, like the Citroën DS, you know. You can see that it's kind of something that is supposed to drive Pompidou, you know. It's not designed for Richard Nixon, you know. You know,
right.
it's very unique, and we really, really lost it. And I think that I'm a very, very nostalgic person. And this is something that comes along in my music, you know. This is my previous album. Was Song of the Metropolis. I kind of closed my eyes and I try to play music as I smell a city. You understand what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
And it was very easy for me to do it with Paris, with New York, with Moscow. By the way, I never been in Moscow, but I could still smell it because I'm Russian anyway. You know, and when it comes to England, maybe because I live here, I cannot do it. It is more and more difficult when it comes to Frankfurt, this city starts really to look the same.
Yeah.
If I throw you in the center of seven English cities, there is, you know, main road, you wouldn't see the difference. They all look the same.
Yeah, the architecture is the same. People are ending up looking the same. They're eating the same food. They're listening to the same crappy pop music. You know, it's horrible. Absolutely horrible. Yeah.
It is horrible. I think that the rise of European and new right reflect this fatigue of people from this clear deterioration.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Of our authenticity, because the yearning for authenticity is a humane inclination.
Of course.
You know, I'm a jazz artist, you know, so you, when in the first years, when you learn to play this music, you listen to Charlie Parker and you transcribe Dizzy and Charlie and Miles and Coltrane solos. But at a certain stage, you are supposed to seal yourself in a room and to start to find your own voice. And I remember when it happened to me, you know, I suddenly kind of, you know, for me to learn to play jazz was relatively easy, but I didn't have a unique sound. And only when I started to play Arabic music, I started to sound very, very unique. And I became a special voice. And you know why? Because I'm uniquely ungifted in playing Arabic music. I had to work harder, and I'm still working on it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I understood that the voice, the real voice, is not necessarily something that you are very good at. Sometimes, music is a great example. It actually manifests itself through the hardcore burden, through the struggle. They say, for instance, about musicians that great musicians are horrible teachers. And why? Because they didn't went through this agonizing process of learning. It was very simple for them. They saw and they took the instrument and they basically tried to play. It is the less gifted, those who struggle, those who have to cross minefields in order to become professional, that had to struggle with the rhythm, with their ears, with their, I don't know what else, and with their harmony, or, you know, these are the best teachers because they went themselves through this hardcore process of learning.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right. Gilad, I want to take a short break here, and then, of course, we'll pick up more and talk more about some of the other issues here in the second. I have much more I want to ask you about, really good stuff here. But let's talk a little bit more about some of the things you have upcoming here. Obviously, the concert didn't happen now. We'll see if it gets rescheduled or whatnot. But you mentioned a new album. I wanted to mention, of course, your old book, so people know how to get that if they haven't read your book already. So give us the details and tell us about your website.
Yeah, so my website is gilad.co.uk, gilad.co.uk. You can get most of my materials on my book, not all of it. You can get most of my materials on my website, and not all of it. Even I cannot get my first book in English at the moment. The good news, by the way, is that I'm now becoming a publisher myself. I'm going to publish my music and my books, as well as other people's books and music as well.
Right.
So, you know, I think that, you know, I have something unique to offer. I can see that all publishing houses around us are basically either Zionist or crypto Zionist. I cannot trust them. You know, it's quite embarrassing. So I want to be, or and if now not, they are scared. you know. So exactly. I want something that to publish books that no one dares publishing.
That's great. If you want to do it right, you got to do it yourself, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I cannot trust anyone but me. But I have a new album, and by the way, this is very interesting because obviously my detractors working very, very hard for the last 15 years to silence me, but they've never tried to touch my music, and they realized that it would be a disaster. And as they saw this week, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
And they are hiding now. It reflects very badly on them. But I ask myself, what is it with my new album that drove them mental? And I don't know, you know, it's this new album, the first track is Gaza Mon Amour. My gigs are all sold out. I think that they are disturbed by the fact that I say what I want to say. It's not necessarily political, but it is necessarily impolitically correct.
Yeah, very good.
It is necessarily politically incorrect. Politically incorrect. And then the name of the album is The Whistleblower. And I think that maybe it is the name that freaked them out, because I stood up and asked the question, how, if we are a free society, as we claim to be, you know, yeah, I think that many of us know that is not necessarily the case. If we are a free society, why do we need a whistleblower?
Yeah.
Why do we need Assange to tell us something? Why do we need Snowden to tell us that we are watched? And by the way, I also realized that once we have a whistleblower, you know, we would immediately have the Guardian trying to take care of them and basically silence the dodgy bits. You know, it's very disturbing, you know. I don't think again that it was a conscious agenda, but I see now the Guardian as the heart of the problem, as much as I see the Jewish left not as the solution, but actually as the heart of the problem. I see the Guardian involved in pretty much the same crime against truth. The Guardian is the outlet that manages or sustain this culture of correctness.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and this is why I call them, I'm the one who coined them, the Guardian of Zion. You know, the Guardian of Zion and the Observer of Judea. You know,
right.
It is quite frightening. Now, I don't think that it is very possible that initially there was a real genuine goodwill there. But at the end of the day, these people, not only that they cannot say anything, they cannot even think appropriately. You know, they just have kind of, they set the world into idiotic, misleading binaries, you know, black, white, good, evil, and they maneuver carefully in between. Yesterday, I had 12 o'clock, I had a telephone call from a guy from the Guardian. He was a nice guy, and he really wanted me to be the racist, anti-Semite, you know, hater, that tried to play the saxophone, and he spoke with me for 5 minutes, and he realized that it's not the case at all. And I explained what is my issue with the Holocaust, and I explained what is my issue with Jewish identity. I don't listen, you know, if a state calls itself the Jewish state, you know, and it decorates its tank with Jewish symbols, the first thing that you have to ask is, what is Jewishness? He said, yeah, you're right, you're right. You know, and then he said, you know, it was kind of deadline. He said, you know what? I cannot write this article.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. You know, everything collapsed.
Well, that's just it. They want the boogeyman to exist in the world. That's why they go for these kind of Hollywood stereotypical, you know, kind of images of Nazis and things like that, because it's like it's an expression of the evil that they need in the world. So they have a reason to combat it, and it makes them feel good about themselves too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a self-righteousness. And this is why I argue that progressiveness is a secular extension of chosenness, of Jewish chosenness. Why? Because to say that you are progressive is to suggest that someone else is reactionary. So it's I'm chosen. And this is why so many Jews like to be progressive. Oh, I'm not a Jew, I'm progressive. No, you are uber-Jew. Uber-Jew. This is why I argue that definitely New Left are Jews by proxy. Now, interestingly enough, and I get a lot of crap for saying it from Palestinian solidarity activists, the early Zionists and the early Jewish leftists, to a certain extent, were uniquely anti-Jewish. Herzl, Borochov, Pinsker, Nordau were uniquely anti-Jewish. They said, listen, I have some interesting quotes in my book. When you read what they say about the Jews, about the diaspora Jew, said we are capitalists, we are usurers, we don't produce anything. The most extreme example is Bernard Lazar, you know, who actually said, look at us. We have been expelled from every city. What is wrong with us? And this is something that he said in the late 19th century. It is sickening. And then he looks and he said, we are supremacists. We are chosen. If you read it, you think it must be Hitler. No, but it wasn't. It was, these were the first Zionists, the early Zionists, as we call them. And they said, as usual, oi, but it's not our problem.
Right.
It's not our fault. It's not our fault. Mm. It is all because we don't live on our land. Once we move to Palestine, let's say, once we unite with our land, we will start to walk the soil, and we will build factories, and we would have working class, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, the early leftists, when you look even at Marx, his insight is very anti-Jewish. He speaks about brotherhood.
Right.
He speaks about brotherhood. He said, rather than chosenness, let's all of us unite, which is very non-Jewish thinking. Now, only Jew that is brought up within this notion of supremacy can probably present, very natural for Jews, through self-hatred, to come across this crucial insight, of humanism and universalism, because the self-hatred is the negation of everything Jewish. If you read Lenin, opposition to the Bund, he gave a talk, I think, in 1902 or 1903. If you look for a Lenin Bund speech, it's on the net. And he blames them of trying to maintain this Jewish supremacist call within the kind of revolutionary discourse, which is exactly what Mondovice, JVP, JFJ, JJJ, all these J groups are doing within the solidarity movement. It's exactly a repetition of the same discourse, you know.
Interesting.
It is very, very, very interesting. Now, why I look into these issues? Because again, because I was very busy with my Manchester, maybe I necessarily missed a lot of articles about Benjamin Netanyahu. So if you think that I'm saying something that everybody knows by now, so please stop me and save me the embarrassment.
No worries. No. It's all good. We haven't talked about it on the show before, actually. But tell us about that, about your take on that. And then we could take a short break, Gila, between the segments here. But go ahead.
Okay. So I thought that we were skipping the break already, but it's okay. When it comes to Netanyahu, I only managed to watch it yesterday, and I was shocked, because before the speech I wrote a piece about Netanyahu being the Jewish symptom. Mm-hmm. You know, he really manifests everything we don't like about Jewish identity politics, but is also a great orator. You know, would you be able to maintain the attention of so many imbeciles, you know, that went to the American Congress for 40 minutes and to orchestrate it when they sit and when they are, you know? It's really, really impressive. I'm really impressed with them. I'm not joking. I think.
Well, my commentary to the video was, and the Oscar goes to, you know.
Exactly, man. It is fucking brilliant, you know. Fucking brilliant. But the issue here, that in order to understand this unique person, there is one simple word: projection. Everything Netanyahu says about Iran is a desperate attempt to project his own vile tribal symptoms on the poor Iranian people.
Yeah, absolutely.
He attributes to them every symptom of the Jewish state. He called them war criminal. What war criminal? It is you who is the war criminal.
Yeah.
He blamed them that they want to develop nuclear bomb. You are sitting on hundreds of nuclear bombs.
Exactly.
Everything that he says is projection. Now, if you have a debate, an innocent debate with a friend, and you project, which happened to all of us, he may tell you, Henrik, you know, I think that you're actually projecting now. And you would probably say, oh shit, you're right, oh my God, let me rethink about it. Or in most cases, you may even know when you are projecting. Now, this Jewish leader is standing in front of America political elite, projecting his own symptoms, his own Jewish vile symptoms for 45 minutes, and nobody in the room notices, or even they're not, even if they notice, they don't shout.
Yeah.
And did anyone write about it in the American press? This will be very embarrassing. Am I saying something now that everybody said?
No, not what I've seen. No.
Okay. Oh, no, because I just didn't have time to read, and I wanted to write, but I didn't have time, you know.
There was a couple of people who critiqued again, but I think it comes from the same. What I managed to see was like, no, Netanyahu, Iran is not a, you know, threat, nuclear threat.
I don't even deal with this forensic issue for sure.
Right.
Iran, unfortunately, Iran is not a threat. I'm dying to see an Iranian atomic bomb. This will bring peace to the region. No, I beg them. You know, every time I speak with Ahmadinejad in the phone, you know, oh brother, man, bring it, you know. And it's, no. The other time you say no. But anyway, the issue here, it is so obvious. It's obvious what I'm saying now. You think about it and said, yeah, that's what it is. It's his projection. Now watch it and think everything that he blamed. Look, this is exactly attributing the Jewish symptoms or the Israeli symptoms to the Iranian people. Now, now nobody sees it. Nobody says it. And this is exactly the definition of Jewish power. Jewish power is the capacity, and it's a unique capacity, to silence any criticism of Jewish power. And it's a magical power.
Let me pause you right there, Gilad, and we'll take a short break here. And I want to ask you more about this. I want to talk to you more about that, the projection, looking in the mirror, et cetera, we come back. But let me just tell our audience quickly about the book as well, The Wandering Who, by Gilad Asman. It's called subtitled A Study of Jewish Identity Politics. Do pick it up if you haven't yet, if you haven't read the book. It's available, of course, at his website, gilad.co.uk. We'll have the links up on...
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
You're obviously Amazon all over the world, Amazon.co.uk, UK, and Amazon.com, you know, America. Yeah.
Absolutely. Major bookstores.
Like when people from America or from New Zealand, today I send one to New Zealand, I basically, if the Zionists want to finish me off completely, they have to order 100 a Wandering Who from Amazon once a day. Because it costs me like tons of money to send them. You know, I lose because I'm like 10 quid on a book, on each book.
sure, got it. Okay, now we'll have the links up, of course, and also check out the new albums, folks. The Whistleblower, and then before that, you had Song of the Metropolis. But stay with us, Gilad. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more. Well, when we return, we have much more to talk about. We will discuss Netanyahu invoking the Book of Esther in the U.S. Congress here recently in his speech. We're going to talk about his inability to look in the mirror and if he simply is a good actor or actually believes what he is pushing. We'll also talk about some of the left Zionist opposition to Netanyahu and the widening schism that we now are seeing. Gilad has some very interesting analysis of this situation, and we'll speak more about how all of this, politics, propaganda, etc., has led to the destruction of majority of countries around the West. He is also going to give us the very interesting discovery of his pertaining to Sarah Schulman and her connection to George Soros and the Open Society, as there is a monetary trail here that connects the BDS movement, that is the Boycott, Divest and Sanctions Against Israel, and the Palestinian cause with the LGBT movement. Some really bizarre connections here, and Gilad tells us more about the story. We also speak about the sexual revolution and pornography. Atzmon also tells us why he thinks the global corporate market forces joined with the new left as opposed to the old left when they were disintegrating, breaking it up, pushing the issue of identity politics over workers' unification. This is a very interesting continuation here in the second hour. We go for about an hour and a half, and I suggest that you don't miss it. The website where you can go to sign up and hear more is redicemembers.com, and we have all our programs available going back to 2006, almost 1,000 shows now on a lot of different topics that we find to be interesting and important that we want to make you aware of. You can comment on the programs, you can watch our videos, stream or download, and get access to all the other things that we have for you on the members' website. We'll be back with John Friend, Matt Forney, E. Michael Jones, Marion Van Court, Joshua Blakeney, and many more. But for now, we say thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. But do stay with us. We'll be right back for our members.